Welcome back. We want to move along quickly, so I want to introduce the man who needs no introduction, the Philadelphia treasure himself, the largest sound archive in the greater Philadelphia region, maybe except for Val Shively. Oh, I don't know.
I sold my stuff to Val Shively, all 28,000.
Is that right?
All my 45s were sold to Val. There's some rare ones in there, too. That's where
anyway.
The station is.
That's where the $10,000 one was, huh?
Yeah. Very pleased to have Fred here on Mummers. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred.
I'm working under pressure that you don't know about that I do, and for reasons that you'll find out very shortly. Now, I'd like to correct that. It's the Mummers, and I don't have a good definition of the Mummers because I didn't check the dictionary, but I think that's mimicking, and I think that's the tradition of mimicking what went on in the past history. Let's go on, Tony. Well, that's the national anthem of the Mummers, Oh, Dem Golden Slippers. In my talk, I'd quote liberally from a single source. There's only one book that's ever been written about the Mummers. The title of it is Oh, Dem Golden Slippers, The Story of the Philadelphia Mummers by Charles J. Welsh. Charlie, are you here yet? Charlie's not here yet. I expect him in any moment. I found him. Even the Mummers Museum didn't know where he was. Charlie Welsh, the author, first published in 1970, and I picked it up in Wanamaker's for a second, and then an elaborate version in 1991 by Book Street Press, Philadelphia, PA. Now, this is the book that I quote from. It's a marvelous book, but you can't find it anywhere. So if you get a hold of it, it's got the whole story, as much and more about the Mummers that you do or don't want to know. Who and what are the Mummers? Today, the Mummers are people, and by the way, you can follow this right along because I've given you a copy of my exact speech. People from all walks of life who dress in all kinds of colorful costumes, most often as part of a group theme, and who aim primarily for the big New Year's Day parade up Broad Street, where virtually all Mummers participate. Now, the New Year's Day parade is judged and involves, for the most part, drilled execution of a prepared presentation. However, underlying all this is a jovial, fun-loving attitude which every Mummer feels and tries to transmit to the adoring public, to their adoring public. Every Mummer feels and tries to transmit to the adoring public. Yeah, I've repeated myself. Which lines, that is the public lines, Broad Street, in recent years East Market Street, followed by a continuation south on 2 Street, that is commonly known as 2nd Street to the uninitiated, the 2 Street Parade is not judged as part of the Broad Street East Market Street extravaganza. It is for the residents and clubs who are domiciled in or near 2 Street, the heart of the, or district as we call it, from which so much mummery comes. Now the following types participate, the following types of participating clubs are: 1, the comics; 2, the fancies; 3, the string bands; and 4, the fancy brigades. The comic clubs are divided into groups and brigades. Both units present much of the same material through the brigades, though the brigades, being larger, are usually more elaborate. Themes, frequently of a satiric nature, are often taken from newspaper headlines. Now, a few scattered types of subjects are from television, mythology, history, politics, current events, space, and the list goes on. I won't dwell on specifics, really too many. The current participating clubs are Murray, Good Timers, Hammond, Purell, Landai, and Liberty. The sections that are judged on New Year's Day include Captain, Float, Brigade, Group, Best Couple, Most Original Costume, and Juvenile. It is important to understand that, and I quote, "To take things too seriously is a sign of inferiority," unquote. These are the most uninhibited marchers in the parade and always seem to be enjoying themselves. How else can you explain the strut with a 3-tiered parasol, or maybe 2-tiered in hand, or maybe even 1-tiered parasol? Side bands, usually brass, woodwinds, and percussion, accompany the comics. A swirl of color springs up, and waves of light, movement, and laughter engulf you. Golden slippers, sequins, feathers, headdresses, and all kinds of costumes entice the audience into responses. Now, the following are slides of comics taken by photographer Herb Moskowitz in 1990. It happens to be the last year of my association as a judge with the parade. And by the way, Herb Moskowitz is at present still the official photographer of the parade, but employed by the Department of Recreation of Philadelphia. 1, this is baseball, clowns, jailbirds, cops and robbers, again, spaceman, riverboat jamboree, fake string band, happy yellow umbrellas, Batman blacks, Elvis at Graceland, polka dot clowns, spaceship, and, quote, cats, unquote. Let's move on to the second section. The fancy clubs are broken into brigades, each of which must have at least 40 participants in costume to qualify for prizes. Prizes are awarded for the following categories: the club, trio clown, pantomime clown, captain, handsome trim, juveniles, brigades, king jockey, female impersonator, handsome costume, turn the page, oop, king clown, special mention, trio jockey, and brigade captain. Now, the 3 clubs in current competition are Hog Island, Oregon, and Golden Sunrise. And by the way, I'll interject here, I have a copy of the January 5th paper. The parade was on the 4th because of weather this year, over there, and I'll hold it up at the end so that you can see. It has all of the participating organizations and the order in which they finished and the prize money which was awarded. The Fancy Brigades in recent years have their shows in our convention center because of, among other reasons, the enormity of many of their competition, however, still Broad Street attract the most attention. They are genuine works of art, patience. The fancies must be a carpenter. The frame is usually made of wood and with iron frame, perhaps 24 feet around, padded, and the costume can weigh as much as 85 shoulders, or roll a horseshoe, and the jockey must have their faces painted and beautifully. Trace their origins back to the crowds. The fancies stick more closely to the pageants of the old covers, as many as supplied in Rieskies have supplanted for the fancies and the comedies of fancies. Herb Mosse might add that all of these museum and number three is a patriot. Number four is a joker style. And actually, as long as I last, hence our night parade was just string band started. 2000 guitars and phones met. Moving are part highly each player equipment, February and associate with the country who one that wins on to participate. The
not have seen that dance before. It's of course called the Mummer's Strut. I'd like to just take a minute and give you a little history about how the Mummer's Strut got started. 102 years ago, 102 years ago, the city of Philadelphia authorized a formal Mummer's Parade. And the only thing that they insisted upon was that the members of the band walk in a very straight line. Something like this. Then the city of Philadelphia, after telling us to walk in a very straight line, in its infinite wisdom, decided to put the horse-mounted police in front of all the bands. Instead of walking in a straight line, here's what happened. And honest to God, that's how the Mummer's Strut got started. Thank you.
You could tell all the natives who stood up for them. Thank you very much, natives. Okay, folks, I want to finish this up quickly. Charlie Welch, are you here yet? Charlie Welch is not here. I didn't call him this morning at 6:30. Oh, well. Now, I'd like to take just a few minutes for a few random remarks. Since 1978, the fancy brigades have split off from the fancy clubs and now give their presentation indoors. These occur on January the 1st, regardless of what happens to the rest of the parade. Triple-tiered parasols are a feature of both comics and fancies. As the mummers, or they're called shooters also, that's the earlier name for them, dance the strut, they move the umbrellas up and down to the rhythm of the music, often at times bowing at the waist while doing so. With one step forward and a half step back and repeated a number of times, the pattern is frequently broken by sideways motions to the left or to the right. Flapping of the elbows can be part of the action. Some of you may remember a demonstration I gave at two conventions ago in Kansas City, Missouri, when we danced to a lively set by an indigenous jazz group. You don't remember? Well, that's good. At this stage of life, if I strutted, well, it ain't gonna happen. The parade creates a good deal of publicity for the city. Directly and indirectly, it brings financial well-being. Thousands of visitors come here to see the spectacle. They patronize shops, stay in local hotels, eat in local restaurants, and so forth. Street vendors and small merchants who remain open during the day really benefit from it. The parade also brings business to local costumers and piece goods manufacturers for the parade itself. Thousands are spent on materials. Carpenters and tailors are hired, and buildings are leased in which to work. The prizes range above $350,000, and the cost of police, sanitation workers, and others raise the tab. But the value of the parade does not fit into a simple economic equation. How can one put a dollar value on a city's sense of community? Participant families range through many generations. Today, almost as many participants live outside the city as in South Philadelphia. In 1975, I saw the first two girls join the parade as musicians, as musical members, musician members of the Dick Crean String Band. Today, women participate in all aspects of the parade. They've always done the sewing of the costumes, et cetera, et cetera. Blacks have been in the parade since the beginning. That may surprise some of you, as have all ethnic groups. There's never been an exclusion. Blackface participation was banned in 1964. Curiously, the Mummers Museum on 2 Street in Washington has had few color photos to lend. Now, the following are 10 made available to me. Number one is the comics. These are three youngsters. Possibly a fancy captain. Back to the comics. Okay, that's the first one. Comics, three youngsters. The second is possibly a fancy captain. The next one is a butterfly in the fancies. A
another is a fancy, and another. And then we have the string bands. Furco, January 1st, 1965. Furco, again, the same year. The title of it, I believe, is A Spirit of 76. The next one is Greater Kensington. The next one is an unknown group. In other words, it wasn't... inscription was put on the photograph. And the next one is Those Glorious MGM Musicals, We Believe It's Furco. Okay, I'd like to quote a paragraph from 187, page 187 of Charlie Welch's book. The conclusion that he has in his book is worth repeating to you. The history of the Philadelphia Mummers Parade has been one of growth. Starting in a section of South Philadelphia known as the Neck, it has gradually spread through the city and surrounding areas. As the city has grown, so has the parade grown. Its history has not all been serene, nevertheless. It has progressed and developed a character and distinctive personality of its own. It is raucous, yet dignified, satirical, yet sentimental, but above all, it's friendly. To watch it from the sidelines is to become a part of it. This special quality of warm friendliness is one of its main characteristics, and one that makes it stand out from almost all other parades. There is no feeling of aloofness when the bands begin to play on Broad Street. The gift the Mummers Parade brings to Philadelphia is an atmosphere of friendliness, hopefulness, and fun to start the new year off right. It is the gift of laughter and life. Now, here's some information which you've been waiting for, I'm sure, about the string band recordings. Now, the first label to carry string band recordings was Palda. It was a red label, and 78s, and that was in 1948. I have been unable to trace any string band recording back beyond that, even though they start virtually with the advent of sound recording. Numbers 1 through 17 were all made by the then 10 times New Year's Day champion, the Furco String Band. Oh, as an aside, I am missing only number 108. If you can help me with that, Mike, please do. Some of you may know Paul and David Miller, or about him, founders of Palda. They were soon to start the Essex label and bring Bill Haley and his Comets to the attention of the musical world and others. Opportunists as always, they sold the Essex label to Decca. The brothers were also founders of Somerset Stereo Fidelity, LPs, eventually winding up with the 5 and 10 cent store Allshire label. I'm sure you remember that one. The Miller story should be the basis for a doctoral thesis and, or better yet, a fascinating biography. I've got a lot of information about them, and I've interviewed not only the lawyer that prosecuted them because they didn't pay a number of people for doing their arranging, and also the IRS man that was involved with them, and also Bob Loudon, to whom they owed $35,000 for arranging. Other 78's labels include Apollo, Aqua, Dumont, Furco, Kranz, Linwood, Lulu Temple, Media, Metropolitan, Mercury, Mummers, Pals, Parade, Public, RCA, Real, Regal, Regent, Sega, Signature, Strand, Swan, and Virgo. Now, these are all records, all labels that I have records of. I'm not taking them out of thin air, but that's not the inclusive list. I have never put the inclusive list together. A few of the aforementioned labels made 45s of the string bands. And beginning in 61, the Sure Record Company, with its honcho Leonard Rosen, some of you know Leonard Rosen's reputation, began a series of LPs featuring a single band or a medley of bands. The series ran through at least 72 volumes, Other companies, LP companies, include AMP, ABC Paramount, Furco, Regent, Somerset / Stereo Fidelity, Sauron, Transworld, and Veritable. Again, a very incomplete list. No doubt the Mummers Museum has more, and I haven't even looked in there. When the Mummers Museum was built in 79, I sold them 40 of my 78s. That's before I started collecting the Mummers records. My involvement with the Mummers came in 1971, and I think some of you should know why I'm up here talking about Mummers when I should be talking about Arthur Pryor or somebody from the military concert band world, right? I'm out of fish out of water? Not really. My involvement with them started in 1971. Bob Crawford was head of the Recreation Department of the City of Philadelphia, and he asked me to be a music judge. Now, he had observed my work as general manager of the Symphony Club of Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra and Concert Band. These are the Fleischer Collection orchestras, organizations, I should say. I asked him what the criteria were and where were they committed to paper. He gave me a rather quizzical look and said he was unaware of such. I told him that I'd have to pass this time. The same thing happened the next year, in 1972. And I had a feeling he was going to ask me the third time in 73. So in early 73, I prepared for his approach and created a criteria sheet myself. And I will reach for one right now. Would submit their outline of their presentation. This is string band. And so for a number of the years, but not all of them, I have each club's presentation. They gave it, the representative gave it to the judges who were sitting in a booth facing the presentation beforehand. And so theoretically, we're supposed to be able to look at this and make something out of it. We didn't have time to do that. You got to be kidding. So this is a compilation of those, and eventually this will go to the Mummers Museum. Where else? My wife had her way, it'll probably go to the trash. Of course, when he asked me in 73, I was ready to judge in 74. And by the way, before that, it was political. Those people had no idea. The guy that was head judge or overseer, he didn't know what was going on. He was owned a radio station, and so therefore he was probably politically in, but he didn't know from Adam. Of course, he didn't have to judge. He had to see that those people, the other six people, did the job. How they did it is beyond me. A year later, after I did this for a year, before the next year, 75, my colleague asked for a sheet, and I gave him a blank of what I was using. That's for music only. And then In 75, Crawford appointed me as coordinating judge. I consider myself the head judge, okay? And for my, I was coordinating the my six colleagues. Now they replaced me with another music judge. During the next few years, criteria were developed for the costume and presentation judges. Soon, Mr. Crawford was asking me to suggest music judges. I'm proud to have suggested composer-arranger Bob Loudon, who was really a hero of mine, public school music division head Ed Heilicke, Philadelphia Orchestra members Mason Jones and Saul Schoenbach, Pensy Pops Orchestra Jim Herbert, conductor, and many others whose names I'd forgotten. I'd have to look at the list. Yes? Say that again? Oh, I hope so. That's why their names are on there. After 17 years, my last session was on January the 1st, 1990. For three more years, I paraded for about 10 hours, each parade with a side band accompanying a comic club. I think that's where I developed a rotator cuff problem. So after the third year, I had an operation on that, and that was the end of my sousaphone playing. Since then, I've been enjoying the parade in the comfort of my home, alternating the TV presentation with the Rose Bowl parade and the various football games. Now, I'd like to give you not a closing tune, but this is the second tune, and this is Alabama Jubilee, which is the assistant anthem of the string bands. Also, Furco. While this is being played, I'm going to hold up a few of the buttons that I got over the years. I've got a lot of them. They were all in one bag, but there's still some missing. I've got the first and the last. Charlie, did you come in yet? Charlie Welch, did you come in yet? Charlie didn't show up, huh? Okay, well, it's a good thing because I don't have 5 minutes for him. Now, this is the newspaper article, and if anybody cares, they can come and, you know, they're always getting in trouble with some theme. And in this case, I won't elaborate on it, but you can see the headline, Skit Not What It Is Quacked Up To Be, you know. But anybody who wants to read about that can do that. I think I'll stop there. Are there questions? Yes. take me a minute to clear out, Sam.
Hmm?
It'll take me a minute to clear out.
All right, take your time.
Does this man want to use my flashlight because...
No,
because
I don't think he has any pictures. Okay. Thank you very much. That's a hard act to follow in a lot of ways. And fortunately, we have an eloquent speaker, as eloquent as Fred, to follow him. I've been an admirer of Francis Davis's writings for many years, in particular the breadth of his writing as well as the depth. Someone who has written on a book on the blues, which is about to be reprinted, and is equally insightful on opera or Sondheim, which is a love of mine, on a wide variety of subjects. Francis Davis is a contributing editor to The Atlantic magazine, is at work on a book on Coltrane. We had a nice presentation on Coltrane earlier, the day before yesterday. And there's a Francis Davis reader in the works. As I said, eloquence of his writing was recently pointed out to me, and sort of as jazz critics are sometimes want to do or forced to do, sort of rebut each other. There was quite a debate in the Jazz Times that Francis was a part of, and his rebuttal to some criticism was just calm, eloquent, and reasoned, and I think it ultimately led to the dismissal of the other writer from his job. But I don't think it was Francis's fault. The guy did himself in. In any case, I'm very pleased that he's taken time out of his schedule to come down here and talk to us, Francis Davis. Thank you. Can you have a seat in? Yeah, so I'm going to give it to Brian here.
Okay. I'll be doing it at the end. Okay, I'm not responsible for Stanley Crouch getting fired. That's what Sam was talking about. So I don't know if the joke that I was planning on opening with is in good taste any longer. But originally, Stanley and I were going to do this together as Reuben and Clay from American Idol. that's right. But Stanley, who was going to be Reuben, said that he wasn't willing to lose that much weight. Those of you who get the joke, kind of explain it to the others, and we'll use the buddy system here. I got an interesting email the other day, and I know that...